kommt heraus aus euren Trümmern, kriegt hervor aus eurer Not. Erst wenn wir uns selbst drum kümmern, wächst im Frieden unser Brot.
Vorwärts und Sieg ergeben, wohin und im Herzen gehen.
Heute Morgen kamen die ersten Berichte im Radio, zufällig im Deutschlandfunk, über den Widerstand der tschechischen Bürger 1961. Am 21. August versuchten sie zum Beispiel, vertauschten sie zum Beispiel die Ortsschilder um die russische Armee, die eben einmarschierte, in die Irre zu führen. Das ist ihnen teilweise dann auch gelungen. Sie sprühten zum Beispiel auch Sprüche an Häuser, wie zum Beispiel Lenin wach auf, Brezhnev ist durchgeknallt. Ihr wolltet doch zum Mond, was macht ihr hier? Dies schreibt Jarosz, one second, Rudis, Jaroslav Rudis, heute in der FAZ und fragt sich, wie wäre der Erneuerungsprozess ausgegangen, wenn er am 21. August nicht von den sowjetischen Panzern plattgefahren worden wäre. Wäre der Staat wieder nach Westeuropa zurückgekehrt, aus dem er nach dem Zweiten Weltkrieg gewaltsam herausgerissen wurde? Wäre der Prager Frühling auch in andere Länder hinübergeschwappt und hätte er zum Zerfall des gesamten Ostblocks geführt? Hat Gorbatschow von Dubček gelernt? Waren die Reformkommunisten nicht in erster Linie vor allem Kommunisten, die um jeden Preis an der Macht bleiben wollten und nur deswegen den Wünschen des Volkes nachgegeben haben? Sollen wir stolz auf sie sein? Ob sich die Tschechoslowakei in ein demokratisches Land verwandelt hätte oder einen dritten Weg gefunden in einen demokratischen Sozialismus, das sind Fragen, die eigentlich offen bleiben. Wenn man sich heute auch noch den Kommentar anschaut von Karl-Peter Schwarz, von Brezhnev zu Putin, dann ist der 21. August 68, aber der 89er gehört auch dazu. Etwas, das zwei Wochen nach dem Beginn der russischen Aggression gegen Georgien liegt, etwas ist, das uns jetzt näher steht als eben vor 10 Jahren oder eben vor 20, 30 oder auch 40 Jahren. In einem gewissen Sinne, meint Herr Schwarz, ist der 21. August auch vergangene Geschichte. Mit dem Einmarsch in die Tschechoslowakei hatte das Politbüro der Kommunistischen Partei der Sowjetunion bestätigt, dass totalitäre Systeme nicht demokratisierbar sind, sondern sich entweder mit Gewalt behaupten oder zusammenbrechen. Dass sie zusammenbrechen, konnte man eben 1989 dann erleben. Seitdem hat sich aber keine russische souveräne Demokratie herausgebildet, sondern ein autokratisches und repressives Regime, das jetzt gerade nach dem Einmarsch in Georgien umso deutlicher wird. Bis heute sind wir ebenso wenig in der Lage, die Souveränität der Nachbarstaaten aus der Perspektive Russlands. Wird die Souveränität der Nachbarstaaten nicht akzeptiert, wie vor ihr eben von der Sowjetunion und auch vom Zarenreich diese Souveränität nicht akzeptiert wurde. So meint Karl-Peter Schwarz, das ist eben der wahre Kern des hohlen Geredes über die angebliche russische Furcht, vom Westen eingekreist zu werden. Denn von den freien und demokratischen Staaten an seinen Grenzen geht keine Gefahr für Russlands Sicherheit aus. Gewiss, Russland hat sich dramatisch gewandelt und es wäre abwegig, wollte man die vielen positiven Veränderungen leugnen. Dies trifft auch auf China zu. Aber der imperiale Großmachtanspruch ist jedoch der gleiche geblieben und er wird immer noch mit Panzern durchgesetzt, wenn es kleine Länder wagen, sich ihm zu widersetzen. Und da spricht er eben die Länder der EU an und auch die NATO, die eben dem sowjetischen Imperium entronnen sind. Und dass sie diesem entronnen sind, wissen sie. Inwiefern sich das auch auf nationalistische Tendenzen beziehen kann und wie dies im Zusammenhang steht, möglicherweise mit 68, das diskutiere ich mit Lauren Langman. Er ist ein Social Theorist und schreibt in der Tradition der Frankfurter Schule. Und um das kurz hier zu beschreiben, er beschäftigt sich eben mit den frühen Annahmen über Charakter und Kultur, als auch über Fragen nach Identität und Hegemonie in einem globalen Zeitalter. Und gleichzeitig untersucht er auch die Natur des Selbst, Subjektivität und auch Modernität. Er hat aber auch genauso über islamischen Fundamentalismus und Terrorismus geschrieben, als auch über alternative globalisierte Bewegung und auch die Cannibalization of Culture. Er ist Professor an der University of Chicago und über seinen Vortrag 1968 to 2008, Diary of an Activist Generation, spreche ich jetzt mit ihm in dem Gespräch.
Left-winger, but I didn't become a radical until I was tear-gassed in 1968.
Yeah, so you became a radical until...
That's when I basically moved from being the equivalent of a Democrat, because we had the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that... Do you have a copy of my paper?
I got the handout, but I got not the paper, but I was listening and...
All right, I will send the paper to you as soon as we're done with the conversation.
Okay, that's great.
But in the paper, which is much, much longer than the handout, but in the paper, I talked about three basic things. Chicago 68, which was the convention, Prague Spring, which a lot of people are comparing to what the Russians did in South Ossetia, but it's a completely different thing. It's a completely different thing.
Yeah.
And Paris Spring. And, you know, I had been opposed to the war in Vietnam, and I had worked, ironically enough, I wasn't in friends were, but I worked with a couple of people that had been old-time communists. I was not a communist at the time. I wasn't that radical.
Yeah.
But when the soldiers tear gassed us in front of where the Democratic Convention was being held, that's when I lost any faith in a capitalist system, and I've never, 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 ever at any moment to rethink my position. If anything, I'm even less optimistic about the nature of capitalism, because it depends ultimately on... You know, the privilege of the rich and the force that can always be applied to the poor. I know that's not an original statement, but I just felt that very, very much. What kind of a government turns, you know, the military and soldiers and tear gas and police on their own people? You know, that's what you expect in places like, interestingly enough, Pakistan just got rid of Musharraf for that purpose. And so that's how I was a graduate student at the time. I thought I was going to become a psychologist.
Yeah.
But in fact, and I did kind of pursue it for a while, but I became more and more convinced that psychology could tell us why certain people are miserable or certain people are happy, or why some people might become activists and others not. But it can't tell us what the social causes of activism are. In other words, you know, structures of power, structures of wealth, the control of government. These aren't psychological questions, and anybody that reduces them to psychological things, it's just pure reductionism.
Yeah. and when did you become interested in the Frankfurt School? Has this something...
Well, you see, this is a very interesting biographical question.
Yeah.
Coming from a Jewish background,
yeah,
I always wondered, you know, and I don't want to go into my own family craziness, but I always wondered, how could people ever hurt other people? How could people enjoy inflicting pain, suffering, and humiliation on other people?
Yeah.
And before I really had any idea of what I was going to do when I grew up, as an undergraduate, I read Eric Fromm's Escape from Freedom.
Yeah.
And that book, it just opened up so much to me. When I teach the course, I still use my original copy from when I was a student and read it as an undergraduate.
Yeah.
And it was basically reading Fromm, and I read Fromm much more. I read Fromm before I read a great deal of Freud or Marx. And it was really through Fromm that I did come to Freud and Marx. Now, since I'm very sympathetic with Eric Fromm's notions on character, my own theory of motivation is somewhat different, but I don't want to go into that now. Maybe later we talk about social movements.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was just an understanding of how it can happen that a people, and I think one of the valuable things about Fromm is when he says a people, because what happened in Germany in 1933, we see elements of it happening in Turkey in 1921 against the Armenians. And I hate to say it because it makes me so very, very sick. It really makes me upset to see the way the Israelis treat the Palestinians. And we can just go on and on and on. If we look at the history of Latin America, how so many people were arrested, tortured, and thrown out to sea.
Yeah.
It was something I could never understand, why people could enjoy hearing the sounds of human beings suffering.
Yeah.
That's where my daughter wound up completely spoiled rotten.
Yeah.
By me.
Okay.
I never let her suffer.
Okay, that's great. But the question is, in Frankfurt in the 50s, Fromm was persona non grata, so he was not...
I know the whole history of that.
Yeah, how do you reflect
on the Frankfurt School, one of the people that wrote a very, very superior book is a guy named Stephen Bronner. Do you know Stephen Bronner?
No.
He actually does come to Germany occasionally, but he has a very, very lengthy chapter. By the 1950s, the people in the Frankfurt School really did not like Fromm for a number of reasons. One, they think he moved from Marxism to mysticism, which may be true. Secondly, they were kind of struggling as aliens in a land of complete, I don't know how much I can say on recorded.
You have time. It's no
well, a completely, you know, repulsive mass culture of ignorance and silly sentimentality. And yet Fromm, by 1941, had become a public intellectual, was acclaimed, was, you know, had gotten the fame, the notoriety, the wealth, etc., that was to be denied to the Frankfurt School. Plus, from what I gather of people that knew them personally, and the only person I know even remotely connected as a personal friend is Peter Marcuse, and he would never say a bad thing about anyone. There were personality clashes that... it's almost as if he served his purpose introducing Freud to the Frankfurt School, at which time they told him, thank you, now get lost.
Yeah.
And a couple weeks ago in at our Boston American Sociological Association, we had a panel on Adorno 40 years later, how Adorno in particular, the Frankfurt School in general, influenced people's work. And I talked about the four areas in which I kind of work, which are, you know, social movement, you know, social justice movements.
Yeah.
The popular culture, what I call the carnivalization of culture, which I don't think I talked about there. That's the people that go to the rock concerts and the metalheads and the goths and the punks.
Yeah.
People who are basically responding to the alienation of late capitalism, but their response is basically reproduce the system by ignoring political economy. And then, of course, the dominant forms of that maintain conformity.
Yeah.
You look hard enough, you can find this almost straight in the pages of Fromm. Nationalism, religion, I mean ultra-nationalism and orthodox religions, especially fundamentalist religions, and consumerism. And one of the things that which is so important to me about Fromm reading in the 1950s is what he began to talk about the marketing personality, which I think he did in The Sane Society or Man for Himself.
Yeah.
But he said these things in the 1940s. Very few people were making making that critique of consumerism that he made in the Frankfurt School. The most typical, the most dominant consumer critic was, of course, Marcuse. But Rome was really so spot on, and in fact, so much of my own writing is on consumption.
Yeah. So, and you were in contact with Marcuse as well? No.
I never knew Marcuse. Now, here's what's really interesting.
Yeah.
Short time, I went to Brandeis, where he was teaching.
Yeah.
But at that time, I thought I was going to be a psychologist, and I was studying with a very, very well-known at the time American psychologist named Abe Maslow,
uh-huh.
who had that theory of the hierarchy of needs. On the one hand, Abe Maslow was the most wonderful person I've ever met.
Yeah.
On the other hand, he reminded me of Prince Mishkin and Dostoevsky's The Idiot. Not that he was an idiot, he was a brilliant man, but he could see no evil in the world. All he could see is the tendencies of goodness and kindness and human decency. And, you know, I just saw too much death, destruction, degradation, alienation, commodification. I kind of outgrew that. It was, you know, and then he himself, somewhat like Fromm, sort of came to mysticism at the end of his life.
Yeah.
That's a path that I have never taken.
Oh, okay.
And never will.
Okay.
Or if I ever do, then at that point I'm completely irrelevant.
Okay. And from this perspective of the Frankfurt School, but more from a psychological perspective, how would you acknowledge now 68 through the Frankfurt School?
Well, as I said in my paper, that the basic, one of the important things in the sociology of social movements was trying to explain the change in movements from what's sometimes called interests to lifestyles. In other words, most of the traditional movements, and to a certain extent even civil rights was involved in this, had to do with organizing unions, getting better pay, health standards, retirement, what the welfare state at one point promised, and at least American neoliberalism is trying to retract.
Yeah.
But a whole number of things began to take place in the 60s, and this is why I talked about this in the paper, the growth of feminism. And that civil rights was not simply, at least in the United States, was not, and I could say much the same in other places too. I've written on Franz Fanon, and he has said the same thing, that the civil rights movement was not just about ending income and job equality and personal prejudice, but granting people recognition, granting them dignity, giving them a sense of meaning for, you know, approval of their identity, recognition that Nancy Fraser has talked about so much, even though the concept goes all the way through psychoanalytic theory, and basically you can be found in Hegel most clearly in the master-slave dialectic, and I'm not enough of a philosopher to trace it back to the pre-Socratics, but it might be there. And so these movements, the feminists, yes, they were, many of them did, you know, attack the job situation and the sexual harassment that goes on in workplaces. My wife is a medical sociologist. She does psychiatric research.
Mm.
And some of the kind of research that she does shows that how women face a variety of stressors on the job, from being propositioned if they're attractive or denigrated if they're not, et cetera, et cetera. So, of course, these are real issues, the unemployment, you know, the employment barriers, the glass ceilings. But part and parcel of feminism was not simply a matter of getting, you know, $3 an hour or more, but the recognition of females as decent, worthwhile human beings with as much equality, with as much whatever, as men have. And then one of the things that I pointed out in the paper is, had it not been, at least in the United States, had it not been for the civil rights movement, that we'd have never had either Hillary Clinton as a candidate or Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting, mentioning that, you know, I had a doctor's appointment this morning, my physician now is a lovely, lovely young woman. And, you know, from the point of view of medical sociology, women, I'm not going to say they're better or worse doctors, but there's a big difference between men doctors and women doctors. Women doctors spend more time listening to their patients and tend to be more proactive. Mm-hmm. This is a research finding. So the point here is that many of the things that took place in 68 are still with us, and they're often not recognized as such. Now, in terms of my work, you know, I work in a number of areas, and sometimes people think that it's I'm very scattered. For example, I've written on Islamic fundamentalism, and I've written on Britney Spears and Paris Hilton.
Yeah.
What do they have in common? Well, they themselves, not much, but the Frankfurt School offers me a way of looking at, you know, popular culture, mass culture, the culture industries on the one hand, and the nature of celebrity as a commodity on the other. And my writings on Islam have looked at how the legal system in the 1100s created an incentive for the growth of trade, but it also created barriers to how far that trade would expand, which meant that by the 1500s, especially by the 1600s, European trade had surpassed Islamic trade because it depended on Weber's notion of rationality. And as a result, at least in my interpretation, one of the reactions of many of the Muslim countries was a feeling of ressentiment toward the West and cutting off many of their ties with the West, which kept them from developing a more advanced modern form of economy. It's changing now. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is that the Frankfurt School has been such an enormous influence in so many different ways. It acts as a way that so many things come together. I mentioned earlier something or other about, maybe it was in the email to you, early in the conversation, about what's happening with Russia. Well, I'm done with my Carnival book. It still has to be revised for publication. But my next book is on nationalism.
Okay.
To a large extent, even though I'm very much in terms of the nationalism literature, you know, Gellner, Hobsbawm, et cetera, my take on nationalism is social psychological, and it's one of the things that's most important in nationalism because it's not just a social movement valorizing the nation state. But it also involves very, very intense passions and love and desire. In an article I wrote that maybe I'll send you in a few minutes, I begin by noting that far more men have died for the love of their country and the pursuit of, you know, of wealth and power than over the love of a woman, at which time I even noticed that Helen of Troy, the part of what made her so attractive, is that Troy had a very, very strategic position in the trade routes at the time. So the capture of Troy not just would result in true love and passion, but also controlling much of the trade in that part of the Mediterranean.
Yeah, and but you mentioned Russia, and I think it would be interesting if we come to the to 68 and what happened in Russia and China, because that was a very interesting point that you made in your paper about...
Well, you know, what's really kind of interesting, what's very, very interesting, and we can talk, you know, I'll make sure that you know when my nationalism session is going to be in Barcelona.
Ah, okay, so I will attend it, yeah, great.
But one of the things that I've argued is that because of the social psychological aspects of nationalism, and here we can go all the way back to reading Fromm, that one of the great problems of both Soviet Union and China, and I can say this because I'm a Marxist, was that they had very, very inefficient systems of production, that their particular kinds of authoritarian communism didn't produce. So they were able to produce weapon systems and, you know, great singular projects, but not very much of an economy.
Yeah.
And eventually, the Soviet Union fell apart, and the China went through their great leap backward. They said forward, but it was really a leap backward, which led them into weakness and a certain kind of ressentiment and shame. And then my argument on nationalism is that globalization makes it more likely, not less likely. How so? Well, one, because globalization changes the world so rapidly, it leads to major population shifts, changes in, you know, in the economy, factories close, high-tech industries open, etc. It leaves a lot of people, you know, unmoored in these various, you know, flows, to use a nice Castells-type term. And the embrace of either nationalism or fundamentalism or combinations gives people a solid sense of self, gives them a, gives them a cohesive group in which they can be a member. It gives them a meaning to life. It gives them a purpose that's been being attacked on several fronts. And so one of the things that it's also done, globalization has done, is also given Russia enormous economic power because Russia controls so much gas and oil. And I don't know, I guess you must get some of your gas and oil from Russia and Germany, don't you?
Again, what?
Some of your gas, your petrol.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it's from Russia, yeah, some of it.
And you get most of your bows and small electronics from China.
Yeah.
And in India, they do all the software and read your medical tests.
Yeah.
Now that these countries have recovered from their periods of stagnation, they're basically gaining pride in their renewed power. And this was very, very much what was happening, in my interpretation, of what was happening when Saakashvili...
Yeah?
I don't understand why he attacked. I mean, this was, like, almost bizarre.
Yeah. See, I think it's different because Russia was really waiting at the border. So why did they wait is the question.
You know, as I said, because we've had a number of discussions on my internet group, and as I said, one of the things that I learned in first grade is never start a fight with somebody 10 times your size.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that he was goaded into it by the McCain people in order to give them a campaign issue, when in fact it looks like it's backfiring because now a lot of people are looking at the fact of... the fact that the United States really now is a paper toothless tiger that can't do anything except make some noises and obscene gestures, the word declining power. But anyhow, I will talk about that in Barcelona.
Yeah. Okay, that's very interesting. But it's still, I think, maybe a point in how 68 did not happen, or in a different way to what happened in the West. In the West, it was maybe a reaction, like you said, on the Vietnam War, for example.
Well, I mean, to a certain extent, there's a parallel of sorts between Russia going into South Ossetia and Russia going into Prague.
Now,
the difference, however, is that going into South Ossetia, they were provoked into it. They'd been, you know, in both cases, they want to maintain power over their sphere of influence. And this is the kind of thing that a political scientist is better at talking about than me. But generally, every major power wants to control what happens on its borders. And this has nothing to do with whether or not it's a liberal democracy or an authoritarian state.
Yeah.
But most countries want to have neighbors that are not threats.
Yeah.
And so the difference is that Georgia had already become an independent state, but Russia was not very comfortable with some of the moves toward independence, including potentially joining NATO. As many people here, at least the left commentators, have pointed out, the United States would not be terribly happy if Russia started putting military bases in Mexico and Canada, and we would violently protest that. Well, that's basically what the Russians not only were doing, but now they have the strength to do something about it, because all of the people in the West that are buying oil or gas from Russia are basically refueling the regrowth of their economy. And this is a very, very normal, typical kind of thing. I think they may have acted with a heavy hand, but that's the Russian style. But, you know, in this particular case, I think that it was completely the United States and the Georgians that were at fault. And, of course, here one of the points I make about nationalism that ties into some of my work
is
that on the one hand it is a cultural force that ties into people's emotions, but on the other hand it's also a contested terrain where various economic and political struggles take place. And now here I'm very much of a Gramscian that certain historic blocks compete to control the population's understanding. Anyhow, I do think that there's a similarity in terms of in both cases, Russia did not like what was taking place on its flanks in 1968. And today, Russia had the power to exert some control over its, you know, dissident satellites, if you want to call it that, although Georgia was no longer a Russian satellite.
Yeah.
But what happened, the big difference of 68 and what happened in Georgia, is that in Georgia, they were provoked into it. Now, they had given warnings to Saakashvili
Yeah.
You know, and he just, you know, attacked Russia. He just attacked civilians and Russian peacekeepers,
yeah.
And it wasn't expected. It was out of a clear blue sky, and of course the Russians acted, did a very, very strong response.
Yeah.
You know, sure, they could say it was peacekeeping and humanitarian efforts, but they wanted more than just peacekeeping humanitarian efforts. They wanted, these are the words I think of Medvedev. They basically wanted to teach the Georgians a lesson and humiliate them. And they did. And I think they deserved it. I think they deserved that.
Yeah.
I feel very sad for all the people that have been pawns in these, you know, horrible nationalist struggles, which gets us all the way back to where I started, of how I became interested in these things, of not being able to tolerate human suffering, that people shouldn't suffer at the hands of others. And here, and I don't want to sound like I'm going mystical, but I think that people should care about each other and support each other and care for each other.
Yeah. Yeah, so there it would be very interesting to come probably to Habermas and how he was criticizing the protest movement 68 because of the violence that happened.
Well, you know, I know that on the panel, the other person was talking about Habermas, but I personally say I have major differences with Habermas on a lot of things. And I've met him, and he's a very pleasant man, and he's very funny in person, much funnier than he is in his writings.
Yeah.
But I find that his early material on crisis is excellent. His Legitimation Crisis is a magnificent book. At one time, I used Knowledge in Human Interests.
Yeah.
But I think that when he made the move, which he started making in that period in the 60s, that culminated in the communicative position, I think he lost track of what's extremely important, and that's the body, emotion, passion. And so when he recasts Freud, he uses the Freud of the clinical situation, the psychoanalytic interpretation.
Yeah.
Distorted symbols, distorted communication. He ignores the psychoanalytic notions of desire, of passion. And even though I'm not an Orthodox Freudian, in the Orthodox Freudian perspective, you do have a role for the death instinct and for aggression. And I think when he moved to communication, that all got lost. And you see this very clearly in his notion of morality, where he moves from Freud's superego.
Yeah.
The basis of authoritarianism in the Frankfurt School, he moved from Freud's superego to Kohlberg's Piagetian model of morality. Kohlberg was one of my teachers, and I have to tell you, I wouldn't give you 2 cents for his model.
Yeah, me too. I don't like that too. But I think Habermas is not really relating to it in the time. But maybe it has to do something, and probably that would be interesting if you could tell something about that, because he's always reflecting, or he was reflecting in this time through the 50s, how a civil society can come up again in a society which lost norms, like lost all norms somehow. And the question was how to recreate these norms, like
That's sort of the problem. Is whereas you know, for nationalism, and I'm not making a very original statement here, in no way, shape, or form. And in fact, Craig Calhoun is going to basically take the other side, but we basically agree on most of this. To me, among the most important doctrines on nationalism go back to Kant, especially the notion of eternal, perpetual peace.
Yeah.
And when Kant wrote about the Enlightenment and about nations, he envisioned the nation as the guarantor of human safety and the promise that if people could live in nations, they would live in peace with each other, each respecting the culture of the other. Well, you're a European, you know that that's not exactly what happens in the 18th and 1900s.
Yeah.
But that, I think that that particular Enlightenment-based notion, for all the critique of the Enlightenment that the Frankfurt School has made, I still think has something to, you know, to offer being recast. Now, the problem is, when you look at the way I look at nationalism, is it depends on people's consciousness, their emotions and passions, which is very, very much like the way I look at the new social movements. The new social movements, when all is cast aside, are attempts to transform a society through the transformation of identity, not simply a policy of anti-war or whatever, but a policy of human dignity and a new type of identity. This is not original. This is what, you know, Turane and Malucci were arguing. And I think that to a certain extent, when Habermas, trying to find a replacement for nationalism, moves to constitutionalism and the love of the Constitution. Well, I don't know what the German students are like, but if I ask my students to mention just one of the amendments to our Constitution that guaranteed some rights, I don't think more than 2 students in 30 could name one of the 10 bills of rights, you know, freedom of assembly, speech, or freedom from, you know, unwarranted search and seizure, right to habeas corpus, etc. Now, you could argue that these are no longer valid under the Bush administration, but, you know, the problem with Habermas, and this is, of course, the problem with, you know, with his approach to morality, it's, as we say, and I was trained, I actually had more training in clinical psychology than I did in philosophy. I actually went through psychoanalytic training. But as we say, in a clinical situation, it's all from the neck up. It's a talking head. The words are right. Where is the passion? Where is the feeling? And it's not there. And people do not move on the basis. This is the problem that the left has always had, especially in electoral politics.
Yeah.
In the United States, we ask, how can anybody be so stupid as to vote for a Republican? Well, people don't vote on the basis of intelligence. They vote on the basis of images and feelings and passions. The left is always trying to bring facts against feelings, and it's a waste of time. This is why I'm not as enamored with Habermas, because there is no role for feelings, emotions, and identity in his work. And this gets us back to my approach to the new social movement. These movements came out of the events of 1968, and as I argued there, and I still do, these are very, very much tied to, you know, the transformation of society by changing the nature of identity now, by debating and renegotiating of what kind of people we are. Are we people that care about each other, that want to offer each other mutual support, that want to find close, cohesive communities, or are we societies in which the only dominant values are wealth and power, which are strictly, which come out of the commodity form? I can tell you, and I mean this again, is not an original finding. People have done research on this for 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
Once people aren't hungry and they don't have to worry about the rain hitting them and the weather,
really anthropological,
they're not that much happier with more money.
Yeah,
sure, it makes it a lot easier if you have, you know, like I couldn't travel back and forth to Europe as often as I did. You know, if I was making one-tenth of what I made. But money does not bring people the happiness that it promises, which means that people seek more and more. And it's the same thing with consumerism. More people buy does not make them happy. It just gives them a momentary high at the moment of purchase, but it wears off. It's like a drug. And what do people do? They go back for a bigger high by buying more and more. Like, I can think of 2 students I had in my consumer class.
Okay.
One of them had over 100 T-shirts, and he admitted that he hadn't even worn most of them.
Okay.
The other wrote in her paper, a woman said, I have 200 purses, and I love every one of them. And I did something a professor should never do. Never, ever, ever. Wrote in the margins of her paper, get a life.
Feel
so bad about that.
Okay, I understand. But to come back to 68, from a retrospective perspective, it's for us it looks like that the student movement in Germany, it adopts somehow what happened in the States. The social movement that happened in the States was different to what happened in Germany. So Habermas' critique on the 68 movement was that they had to be more
that they had to be more to be concentrate on the reform of the universities and not in adopting what a social movement from somewhere else.
Well, I'll have to be very, very honest here and admit that, except for some basically, headline events, and for example, when Adorno called the police on the demonstrators, I can't speak with any authority about the German social movement, but I know that any kind of a social movement, whether it's an anti-war movement or gay, lesbian rights or any of these movements, is always going to take place in different ways depending on the social historical context, which is one of the reasons why, and I don't know if this was in the handout, but surely it's in the paper, which I'll send you in a few minutes. This is why Mannheim's notion of generations is important, because not only do people differ in terms of their generation, but their sort of cultural histories. And, the cultural political history of Germany after fascism is going to be one that's, going to be very, very different than a country like the United States that is skirted with not fascism, extremely authoritarian governance as we have now that may not even make fascism necessary.
Yeah.
So, I know more about the French movements or the American movements and the German movements, and so, I don't want to make a fool out of myself and say something off the top of my head that has no bearing on facts about what happens in Germany. I really can't speak to that, and I know many of my activist friends can talk a lot more about it than I can.
Yeah.
One of the things that's just a little tiny bit interesting, an interesting take, one of the people that I spent a lot of time talking to about movements in the 60s was a woman named Marilyn Katz. Okay, let's fast forward. You don't know the name because she's an activist, although she's also a very successful publication executive.
Okay.
She learned her public skills, her people's skills in SDS. In 2002, when Barack Obama was running for the Senate, she and my other buddy Carl Davidson, Carl Davidson was one of the signers of the Porcheron Statement, they organized an anti-war rally in 2002 where Barack Obama spoke. It was very loud and very public about his opposition to the war.
Yeah.
So when he becomes president, and I'm convinced he will, but a lot of people think that race will triumph self-interest. I don't think so, but we'll talk about this on November 5th.
Then
Obama does become president.
Well,
the historians will trace the rise of his career to that particular speech that he gave in Chicago against the war that brought a lot of national attention because he spoke against the war. And as an aside, next year, my sociology organization, the ASA, is going to be having at least a panel or two on race, the election, and how Obama won, although I should hope it doesn't happen. There may be one instead, why racism led to the defeat of Obama. I hope that won't happen. But I just sent Marilyn an email yesterday raising the question that if Obama wins, given the fact that she knows him, and she's a very, very close friend of his campaign manager, David Axelrod, is there any chance that we could get Obama to come to speak at our social meeting? Now, is that likely to happen? Absolutely not. And one of the things that I also got out of the Frankfurt School from Ernst Bloch, if we don't have dreams, if we don't have hopes, why bother?
That happened in Berlin as well when Obama was here for some weeks.
I saw that. And the McCain Committee compared him to Paris Hilton. And Paris Hilton wrote, Hilton had a comeback video in which he basically called McCain the wrinkled, grumpy old man or something.
Yeah, that's right. But then the discussion in Germany was about this hope, because in the our chancellor, she has no idea of hope. So, how is this? What is the difference in this?
Now, your chancellor is maybe not as bad as our president, but he's pretty bad.
right now. Yeah, that's right. But I got another question about the dialectic of unenlightenment. And you have a critical theory of Islamic fundamentalism. And the question would be, how do you describe this? What can I understand through this critical theory?
Did I send that paper to you?
I found an abstract and I found another text from you on global justice as identity. But I'm interested in this critical theory of Islamic fundamentalism.
Well, I'll send you that paper too.
Okay, yeah, that's
good. As I said, that 1,000 years ago, the most advanced city in Europe was Cordoba, where the Muslims lived and studied.
Yeah.
And at this time, most of the Europeans were running around the forest in loincloths or with horns, you know, killing each other, etc. Except for the clergy, there was no literacy, and the vast majority of people were peasants. And so Islam was economically successful. It was developed scientifically. Their medicine was advanced. Their mathematics was advanced. And you had this, you know, very, very sophisticated culture. And you had pockets of rationality within the universities and the sciences and things like that. But because it was basically dominated by Quranic law, which depended on trained theologically trained jurists, the Qadi, and this is what Weber's argument, that rationality could never spread from the scientific realms out into the larger society and the commerce. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, as things move on, eventually, the Europeans began to rediscover Roman law. Both Marx and Weber talk about the revisions of the Amalfi.
Yeah.
With the Renaissance, we begin to open up, rediscover, thanks to the Muslims, of course, Greek science, and we begin to rediscover the role of the concept and the experiment, which for Weber were the two ingredients that would ultimately make rationality possible.
Yeah.
And so with European, or I should say Italian, commercial law based on evidence coming out of Roman law, as opposed to faith and I have to say, justice, more typical of Muslim law, you began to see the European economy grow. Now, one of the key elements here, one of the very key elements, was the importance of the corporation. What do I mean, the corporation?
Yeah.
The Muslim business was successful.
Yeah.
Sooner or later, one of the owners was likely to die, and the business would get divided up, possibly among the partner, the sons, and sometimes the daughters. But with the joint share company that ultimately becomes the corporation, you can accumulate capital in the person of the organization. And so if you look at the rise of trade in Florence and Venice, these are large families that accumulate this capital over generations. And using the rational methods, just go back to economy and society. My students hate reading the discussions of double-entry bookkeeping. And they complain and they complain, but when they're done, they then see how it was that something like bookkeeping enables corporate accounting and the rise of that kind of business. So by the time European commerce begins to grow and flourish, for a variety of reasons, Islamic societies became stagnant. Another side issue here is that in the 1500s, in the 15th century, the finest canon in the world were the bronze canon of the Turks.
Yeah.
But the European bell ringers soon learned how to make cannon of iron and steel with rifled barrels. Do you know what I mean by a rifled barrel?
Yeah.
Okay. Which meant that European cannon were not just more powerful, but because of the rifling in the barrel were more accurate. And whereas the classical cannon used mostly by the Turks was to break down the walls of another castle,
yeah,
Europeans form of the Islamic armies used cavalries to make their charges. So as Europe was growing more and more economically powerful, there was also what's sometimes called a military revolution, as they basically moved from bows and arrows and spears to gunpowder, but they changed the tactics. And as Weber sort of points out, Michael Mann is excellent on here in his Sources of Social Power.
Yeah.
As the European armies grew, for a gunpowder army, you need a full-time army, as opposed to a feudal army where you have a small army and you go out and hire people. And that feudal army, you know, the mercenary armies of the feudal days began to wane, and you began to get these large bureaucracies that eventually no longer needed the kings to head them. And so between the growth of commerce because of the commercialization or the rationalization of commercial law and the rationalization of the military, the movement from the brave warrior to the well-organized field. And here, once again, Weber's discussion of discipline from the hoplites of Greece to Cromwell's army is absolutely essential. That after the Muslims threw the Christians out of the Holy Land, not 200 years later, it was downhill, and they've still never recovered. And it's part of that ressentiment of having been a great civilization that fueled much of the anger and the resentment about what has happened to their societies, especially in places where there were so many efforts to try to democratize and modernize. So, for example, in Iran, in 1953, the United States and Britain overthrew the Shah. Why? Overthrew President Mossadegh.
Yeah.
Why? Because he was a moderate socialist that wanted to use oil revenues for hospitals and schools. And so by having displaced, having overthrown Mossadegh, what do they wind up with? The Ayatollahs. Pan-Arab socialism was secular and modernist, and Nasser had even wanted to negotiate peace with Israel. And what did they do? They got rid of him. Over and over again, the United States and Britain have been on the wrong side of the politics and the economic. The support, and one of the main things that fueled al-Qaeda was the resentment of the Americans getting the fortune of Saudi oil, having American bases near the Holy Land. And, I mean, I have absolutely no sympathy whatsoever for al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
One has to understand from where they're coming from. And part of it is the fact that the potential of Islam, it was cut off. It was cut off. 1492 is always a good year because of the Inquisition, but not just the Inquisition, but that's when the Europeans discovered the trade routes that would get them away from dealing with Muslims as, you know, caravan trade, and basically go straight to the Orient to get their silk and spices and their porcelain, which then led to the economic stagnation of Islam that really hasn't come back until this very day. And what's interesting is where the Muslims are doing really well, it's in these little teeny weeny 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 places that are the size of, they're not even the size of Frankfurt, you know, Dubai, Bahrain, Qatar. But the Muslim countries as a whole are doing dreadfully. you know, Pakistan has been in the news lately. One of the newscasters was saying, with or without Musharraf, Pakistan faces economic problems. India has been growing about 8% a year. In Egypt, we see food riots because the cost of food is going up and the incomes aren't going up. And so as a result of these things that take place 100 years before, you see how some of these kinds of things work out. You know, one thing I really need to do for, you know, with you is I'm going to send you my Shahadeen, my 2000, the 68 paper.
And I got one question, maybe for the last question, but you are saying in this essay on global justice as identity, mobilization for a better world, you are saying that in situation of conflict, identities are created, negotiated, and consolidated. So the question would be how you, if you could compare the situation of conflicts in the 68 to and what kind of identities were created, and what kind of identities we are creating now through the conflicts we have.
I think that to a large extent, and I think I tried to point this out in my paper, to a large extent, these are actually very, very similar in the sense that in both cases, what they're trying to do is, these are movements of what I'm calling, and I call this in the paper, of democracy, equality, freedom, and inclusion. And the movements failed in the 68 to transform society.
Yeah.
They did lay the groundwork.
Okay.
So every day when I go online, I get at least 15 or 20 emails from various organizations, left-wing organizations that I have some kind of a part of, but most of the people that are running these, not the masses of people, but the people that are running these, are people that were in the movement in the 60s.
Okay.
And so that the social forces haven't changed, and in fact, for a variety of reasons, the world went more conservative, especially the United States, and this has to do with the rise of neoliberalism that really began in the Reagan administration here and the Thatcher administration in England. And these progressive things have been channeled to the side, et cetera, in large part because of the mobilization of the people who have been hurt and left behind. Before ISA begins on on the 4th, there's a one-day...
Go left, up, right, up, right, down, right.
Ja, das war jetzt das Gespräch mit Lauren Langman. Und was er erwähnte ist, wir treffen uns jetzt in Barcelona, da ist die International Sociological Association Forum Konferenz. Und da gibt es verschiedene Sessions zu diesen Themen. Und das ist Anfang September. Jetzt hier im, ich bedanke mich und verabschiede mich hier im Studio am Mikrofon Felicia Herrschaft. Bis dann, ciao. Genau. Die Sendung kann auch unter www.fehe.org/radio dann nochmal gehört werden. Bis dann.
Das Land, das uns alle vereinigt fand, im Kämpfen, im Lieben.